This interview with Nancy Beard was conducted on May 3, 2023 in New Paltz, New York, in a group setting. Other voices on this recording are Fran Dunwell, Kara Lee, and Betsy Blair. The interviewer is Elizabeth Lo-Judas.
I'm going to talk about access to the river today, because that's what I worked on, the access goal, for about 12 years, from about 2010 to 2022, when I retired. And in March of 2022, just before I retired, I presented my annual staff meeting update to staff, as we would do. And as it was my swan song, I presented an overview starting back in the 1980s to give some perspective of the estuary program's role in developing river access and really trying to elevate the estuary as a place that was really worthy of the program and the state's time, energy, and funding. So my remarks today are based on that presentation and reflect my take on the issue and the status of access along the estuary as of the spring of 2022. So back in the 1980s, there was a real growing interest in outdoor recreation that really took off nationwide. And there were reports like Americans in the Outdoors, The Legacy, The Challenge, you know, coming out in 1986. And to document the trend. And a couple years before that, in 84, the New York State DEC published a report, Improving Public Recreational Access to the Hudson River. And they were recommending priority sites for new boat launches on existing public lands for trailered boats to support recreational fishing. And so at this time, you know, the Hudson is really starting to grow in popularity as a place that people could and wanted to seek out to fish, to boat, to maybe even to swim, relax, river watch, and just, you know, learn about the river and had this whole host of outdoor nature-based experiences, really from the, you know, the head of tide all the way down to New York Harbor. And, of course, this continues today. And this certainly was due in large part to improvements that were made in the river's water quality since the passage of the Clean Water Act and other water-related programs that were implemented both at the federal and the state levels over these past, you know, 40, 50 years. And around this time, too, in 1986, the National Park Service hired two graduate students. One of them was my husband, Carl, and Sarah Johnston, who also grew up here in New Paltz, and she worked for the Ulster Environmental Management Council, and she also worked for Clearwater for many years. And they were hired to physically visit, inventory, and catalog all of the railroad crossings across the shores of the estuary. And this came about in response to a proposal by the railroads to eliminate at-grade crossings and potentially raise the height of the existing overpasses on the east side of the river to accommodate double-stacked railroad cars to serve General Motors manufacturing plant, which was in Tarrytown in Westchester County and right on the river. And GM was manufacturing minivans, the Chevy Lumina, the Pontiac Transport, the Oldsmobile Silhouette at the time, and they wanted to expand the railroad capacity along the river line to move these vans to market, you know, bigger, faster, and better. So these trains traveled north up the east side of the river, so this proposal would have impacted the entire eastern shore of the estuary from Tarrytown north to where the trains pass over the river to the west side, south, just south of Albany. And fortunately for the river and for us, the vans did not do well on the market, and GM closed this plant in June of 1996. So while this proposal for the railroad line was not implemented, it brought attention to the issue and the challenges around providing access to the river and the railroad tracks as a significant barrier and a challenge to access. So this inventory ended up being so interesting that they expanded it to include the west side of the river also in all eight counties of the estuary. And this is what ultimately led to the report that we've spoken about before between the railroad and the river, which does a really nice job of outlining the issue, discussing the importance of the railroad crossings in relation to access, and it included 44 examples of opportunities that could be developed into public sites. And over time, many of these sites have actually become public access sites. So this report was supported by numerous agencies who worked together in what they call the Access Forum, and it set the stage to really expand and redefine the concept of what access to the river could be beyond just these trailered boat launches that was DEC's mission for recreational anglers, but to include other kinds of access for shoreline recreation and non-motorized boating. So in the 80s, you've got this growing swell of interest within all these agencies, organizations, and a growing population in the valley who really want to begin to do something to improve access to the river for a variety of these river-related activities. So enter the Estuary Program. So we began in 1987 and really got, you know, rolling in the late 80s and early 90s. And access has always been a part of our program's mission and goals. And so as we've progressed over the years, we've really kind of gone through four distinct stages, starting with this building new and upgrading existing trailered boat launches in the 90s, to providing access in every community along the river through the early 2000s, to improving accessibility at these sites for everyone, including people with disabilities. And then finally, we, just as I was leaving, we were starting to address the future resiliency of these access sites in the face of flooding, storm surge, and sea level rise. So I'm going to take us through these sort of four stages. So stage one began with our first action plan that came out in 1996, and it included this goal to build and upgrade 8 trailered boat launches in areas of greatest need. And this was certainly in keeping with this 1984 DEC report to improve public recreational access to the Hudson River. So there was already this built-in internal support within DEC for this action, so we started with a win-win. You know, this was already something that the agency wanted to do. And at this time, there were really very few boat launches along the river. They were in pretty rough shape and badly in need of repair and upgrading. And there were a lot of stories, you know, you'd hear these all the time in the hallways of anglers and maybe some of, even of our own staff getting the rear axle of their truck or their boat trailer hung up on the ends of these poorly designed or degraded boat ramps. So something really needed to be done. So we did this. DEC and the Estuary Program worked on this. And from north to south, we built and upgraded 8 sites. New sites were built at the Skodak Island State Park, which is sort of on the Rensselaer-Columbia County line. We provided, I think it's $4 million, nearly $4 million in funding to build an overpass to access the site, which state parks had owned for years, but they just couldn't get to it. But with our funding and with the construction of this overpass, Parks was able to build a new boat launch and put facilities on this shoreline property. And further south in Rockland County, a new boat launch was installed at the newly developed Haverstraw Bay County Park, which was developed with help from the Estuary Program also. And then upgrades occurred at the Henry Hudson Park in Bethlehem, Coxsackie, which was a state park site, Athens is a state park site, Norrie Point State Park site, and the city of Newburgh and the city of Peekskill. So those were the 8 sites that we worked on. So these were all in keeping with DEC's mission to support fishing access for recreational anglers, specifically designed for trailered boat launches, and really address the needs of this fairly narrow audience, but one that was in keeping with the DEC's mission. So then we moved into stage two, and this in the mid-2000s, we were preparing an action agenda for 2005-2009, and we expanded our vision to include a wider range of opportunities, and so we set a goal to provide access to the river in every community along the estuary. And this built on implementing the vision that had been proposed in the Between the Railroad and the River report. And Beth Waterman, who was the program's first Access Goal project manager, managed the goal during this time. And she worked on Access for about 10 years before mm-hmm. I did. Mm-hmm. And so we largely achieved this goal, too. And here we really used our Estuary Grants Program, which was started in 1999. And by awarding these were reimbursement grants to local governments and nonprofits, we supported locally funded projects that included fishing piers, non-motorized canoe and kayak launches, wildlife viewing platforms, such as the one at Ramshorn Marsh in Greene County, boating access in urban waters, Governor's Island and New York City Downtown Boathouse and the Hudson River Park on the west side of Manhattan, rowing access for youth and school programs. Examples are Newburgh Rowing and the Hudson River Maritime Museum in Kingston. We supported the development of deep water docks for the Clearwater and other larger vessels to land and host public events. City of Rensselaer has a deep water dock that we funded, and most recently in Milton Landing in the town of Marlborough also. And we even did one swimming site in the city of Beacon, at the installing the little Beacon pool there. So again, these goals parallel these trends that are going on, where the population of the valley is booming, people are discovering the river as this major recreational resource, and kayaking as a versatile recreational sport was really taking off in popularity through the 80s and 90s. And it turns out that the river is really much better suited for kayaking than canoeing if you want to access the main stem. And another thing that's going on at this time is the creation of the Hudson River Valley Greenway Trail got underway in the mid-late 1990s, and they set a goal to designate launch and landing sites for paddlers at regular intervals along the estuary. So many of our grant projects helped further the development of the Greenway Water Trail. So that was a really nice complementary set of projects there. So today, as a result of that, there are more than 100 public access points along the estuary serving all of these different uses. And I just want folks to keep in mind that there are a lot of agencies and partners who are involved in providing access to the river. It includes state parks and New York State Department of State, New York City Parks, Scenic Hudson, Open Space Institute, and all the local riverfront municipalities who are often the owners and site managers. So it's really working together in partnership with all these entities that the estuary program has been able to see its goals fulfilled. So to date, which is March of 2022, when I put this work together, through the grants program alone, we had awarded 120 access grants totaling nearly $6 million. 38% of these served environmental justice areas, which is also a very important component of the estuary program's work. And since just 2015, 73% of our grants awarded had been in environmental justice areas. So with that well underway, we set into stage three, and we started to ask ourselves, what's next for the access goal? And a couple things were happening in 2015 that really affected our next moves. One, the estuary program went through an internal strategic planning process as part of our five-year update of the action agenda. And so now we're looking at the action agenda for the years 2015 to 2020. And even though we'd sort of been doing this at this point in time, we really started to solidify how we were strategically approaching all of our work in the estuary program, and we started to call it Building a Ladder of Stewardship, which set out to engage and inform our partners and communities, assess our resources, and then empower our partners to become leaders in the stewardship of the river by providing support through our grants and technical assistance. And we'd sort of been doing that all along, but we really started to clarify it and sort of define it and put it in writing. And also in 2015, this was the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So there was a heightened awareness in the public arena at this time of the needs and rights of people with disabilities to have equal access to community resources, including outdoor opportunities. So we set our goals in this action agenda to improve accessibility at these Hudson River public access sites that we had helped develop in the previous action agendas, all up and down the estuary. And at this time, we also started to talk about resiliency of access sites, but it wasn't all that well defined at this time. So the idea was introduced, it was sort of bubbling along, but we weren't really taking, it was building momentum, but we weren't really taking concrete action, but we'll get there. So we brought in a couple of new partners at this point, and we started working with Dr. LaWanda Cook from Cornell University's Yang Tan Institute, and Jennifer Perry at the Northeast ADA Center, and those are both based at Cornell in Ithaca, New York. Nordica Holichuk from New York Sea Grant, and our own DEC ADA Access Coordinators. Carol Frazier was the state coordinator based up in Albany, and DEC's Region 3 coordinator was Eva Foster. So we began to assess and bring attention to improvements that could be made to these sites to improve their accessibility. So I'll share two cases where we put this laddership, the ladder of stewardship approach to work in the city of Kingston at the Haverstraw County Park in Rockland County. So Kingston Point Beach is River Mile 92, and it's a very popular access site and one of only two public swimming beaches with lifeguards on the river. The other one's at Croton Point in Westchester County. And the city of Kingston has received many grants from us over the years. And for the swim beach area at Kingston Point, they attended an accessibility workshop that was led by Dr. LaWanda Cook. And then when offered after that, they took us up on having their park further assessed for accessibility issues by Jennifer Perry of the Northeast ADA Center. And it was as a result of that assessment and the recommendations made, the city applied for and received an estuary grant, which resulted in a number of improvements. And they improved their designated ADA parking lot. They installed an accessible beach mat that runs from the parking lot to the head of tide at the swim beach. And this is the only one that I know of along the Hudson. They bought an accessible beach wheelchair for folks who, you know, would need to use that to use the beach mat and access the water. And they made their restrooms, their picnic pavilion, and their changing rooms and shower all ADA compliant. So these upgrades, you know, were really successful. They were just thrilled with this project. And I think this one really shows how we engaged, informed, assessed, and empowered the city to improve this really, really unique site on the river. It's only one of two places where you can go swim with a lifeguard at a sandy beach. So the next case study I'll just touch on is at Haverstraw Bay County Park in Rockland County. So this is a little further south, River Mile 37. And I had mentioned this site before. This was one of the new access sites developed under our first goal of upgrading and developing boat launches. It hosts already many accessible features. It has a rebuilt bridge that goes over a little inlet. And this was a post-Superstorm Sandy repair. This bridge had just been wiped out by Superstorm Sandy. And when they repaired it, they made an accessible lowered railing section so that folks could be on the bridge and they could fish. And they also have an ADA playground and pavilion and restrooms. So in 2016, Rockland County received an estuary grant to upgrade the boat launch docks that were now like 20 years old and install what I'm calling a more accessible kayak launch. There is no such thing as an ADA compliant canoe or kayak launch because there are no standards, so it can't be ADA compliant. So I call it more accessible. So they wanted to put in one of these kayak launches. So at this site, we linked up staff from the Helen Hayes Rehabilitation Hospital, which is located just uphill in Haverstraw, with county staff to visit the site and provide advice on how best to design and install not only the docks, but also this new kayak access feature. And Helen Hayes Hospital is really interesting. It's actually a state facility, and it offers many adaptive outdoor activities for their clients, and they often have to travel really long distances to reach appropriate sites for their patients. And so they were just thrilled with the outcome of this project, located really within 5 minutes of their facility. And it just was a win-win for everybody. I thought it was a really exciting project. And I think this just shows how building partnerships and engaging the community and bringing in people who are going to use your resources, get them engaged and find out what they need to make it successful. So that work, hopefully, the stage three will continue. There's so much work to do, so it's none of this stuff ever ends. But stage four, we start looking at resilience. And in the most recent action agenda, which covers 2021, current day up to 2025, we identified two targets to focus the program's work going forward. And one is to continue to improve this accessibility and inclusion at access sites. And then we added a target to increase focus and helping site owners and managers plan for resiliency to storms, flooding, and sea level rise. So understanding that the Hudson is already being impacted by climate change and rising water levels, we developed the Flood Resilience Handbook, which was designed for site managers and owners of access sites to help them understand the issues and begin to plan and implement strategies to protect their access sites, all these access sites that we've invested in all these years, protect them so that they'll be there in the future. Yeah. And I can't remember exact date, but I think it was the early 2020s that we came out with the handbook. And to complement that, we added to the estuary grants a project type specifically targeting resilience planning. And it's designed to be complemented by the handbook. So hopefully together the handbook and the grants will help communities start to address resilience issues and continue to build on our strategic ladder of stewardship. So in conclusion, I just want to add my own little note about kind of the power of vision. And as I was preparing this talk back in 2022 for staff and getting ready to retire, I really started to think about the power of vision and how important that has been to the whole success of the public access effort along the river. And many of today's public access sites were yesterday's industrial sites. You know, their quarries and brick factories, disposal sites and landfills, oil tank farms, and you know, a lot more. And it's really been through the restoration of these areas that the Hudson's industrial past is being transformed into becoming today's public access. So one site at a time and over time, because we've all been at it for a while now, the Hudson's really becoming and being transformed into a river for the people, maybe more so now than ever before. And this really hit home for me when I was working in my final years with the Arm of the Sea Theater, which is a small, non-for-profit, shoestring kind of budget. But they've taken on this enormous undertaking at their new Tidewater Center on the Esopus Creek in Saugerties, which is a former industrial site that was a paper mill in the 19th century, and it's just strewn with derelict infrastructure and so many challenges and contaminated soils. But they've taken this on, and they have great vision to transform this property. And if it weren't for longtime thinkers, long-range thinkers and dreamers and inspirational visionaries, you know, like the Arm of the Sea folks and, you know, Pete Seeger, Bob Boyle, Fran Dunwell, staff at Scenic Hudson, folks at the Estuary Program, we really wouldn't be where we are today with these more than 100 places and counting where people of all walks of life and abilities can come to the shores of the river and share in its magnificence. And I don't really consider myself really a visionary person. I just kind of get lost in the nuts and bolts and the weeds. But I've really come to a new appreciation and trust for those long-range dreams. And I just feel so fortunate. To have been part of the journey. So that's my overview and my perspective of the work that the program has done and that I've done, and that I handed over to the reins to those who follow.
And it's still going on.
It's still going on, yeah. So that's kind of it. And if there's time, I do have a list of just examples of industrial sites that have been converted. I don't know if you want to include those.
Sure.
Or not. Because this came out of a PowerPoint that I did back in 2022, there were a number of examples that I gave during the PowerPoint of these industrial sites that are now either being turned into or have been turned into our public access sites. And so I'll just run through a number of them that have been transformed. So I'll start with what I just mentioned. The Arm of the Sea Theater has purchased this industrial site that they're calling the Tidewater Center, and it's on the Esopus Creek in Saugerties. It's right next to the Tina Shorbus Public Park right there. And, you know, it once was one of several 19th century paper mills along the Esopus Creek, and it's where paper was first produced in large rolls versus individual sheets in the country, which I just thought it was so cool. So it just has this interesting historic site, and it's, I mean, the first time I went there, I was like, oh my God, what a wreck this place is. But they had this vision, and now seeing these sites being transformed, I believe in it. I trust what they're doing, and they're going to get there. And so we gave them an estuary grant where they capped the soils of the site with 2 feet of clean fill to allow public access for these larger-than-life puppet productions. They opened the site for their open-air performances in August of 2021. They've got some more grants from us to improve the bulkhead along the shore, and they're going to make a walkway on the bulkhead, which will be accessible. And they're going to take what was a coal storage bin, and they're going to turn that into their performance space. So that's Arm of the Sea on the Esopus.
They're amazing. Yeah.
Milton Dock, which was estuary grant supported, in recent years, this is at Milton Landing in the town of Marlborough. It's the town's only public access to the river, and it had a very large damaged industrial pier that was restored to an accessible deep water dock for boats like the Clearwater and potentially much larger ships. This is a really, really sizable, large pier. And the initial engineering studies and permitting processes were funded with an estuary grant, which then allowed the town to seek additional and larger grants to actually do the restoration work. And they have done the ribbon cutting and opened that site. And they also received another more recent grant from us to install a more accessible kayak dock and launch at their site as well. Highland Landing Park, which is also known as Bob Shepherd Park, in the town of Lloyd, was once an oil tank farm, and we've supported the development of this park with several grants to improve parking access and educational facilities. The Haverstraw Bay County Park, which I had mentioned before, in Rockland County, was a staging area in the 1950s for the construction of New York City's Pier 57 and the Tappan Zee Bridge. And the inlet, which is the site of the boat launch, is a remnant from those times. Charlie Ryder Park in the Ulster County, which is DEC and estuary grant supported, was used for spoil disposal in the 1980s by the New York Power Authority when they were building the Marcy South power lines across the state, which became operational in 1988. And in exchange for the use of the site, the Power Authority agreed to put a boat launch and parking area there. And it turned out it wasn't very functional, so the town ended up in a cooperative agreement with DEC. And DEC invested $300,000 to install the double-wide concrete trailer launch and parking area that exists today. And in 2010, the estuary program awarded the town a grant to improve the north end of the site, which now includes a nice level picnic area and access for fishing. And last year, I go down there every year and check it out, and the previous year, so it's 2021, I guess, the town upgraded the porta potty there to be ADA compliant. And I was just really, really pleased to see that. Ingalls Avenue in Troy, which was estuary grant supported, and this site really has a long and complicated history. And it was once the site of the New York State Dam on the Hudson, which existed before the Federal Lock and Dam was constructed just north of the site. This area had been excavated, filled, and later contaminated with a whole variety of wastes, including coal tar from a neighboring gas manufacturing plant and oils and metals from nearby industries. The city, in their planning efforts, identified this as a potential boat access site, and it did have a rather rough access ramp to the river already. And in 2002, we gave one of our earliest grants to the city to investigate and analyze this brownfield site for contaminants. And while it took a long time for the project to come to completion, they built their boat launch and fully remediated the site, and they opened it in 2019. And so this site in particular, I think, is an example that's been used, abused over time, and now is providing public access, and it's also providing other benefits, such as managing the stormwater runoff in a part of the city that has had a long industrial history. Cowawese Unique Area at Plum Point in Orange County, this is New York State DEC supported, was the site of a sand mining operation before being purchased by the state. And this site dodged a very large-scale development proposal back in the 1990s, and it is now managed as a park by Orange County in agreement with DEC. Scenic Hudson's Beacon Long Dock Park was an industrial site, had many uses over the years, including an oil tank farm and salvage yard. And remediating this site was a major undertaking by Scenic Hudson. It cost millions of dollars and has resulted in an accessible, resilient open space and just beautiful access site for the city of Beacon. Sojourner Truth State Park is in the city of Kingston and town of Ulster, and this is a very recent park development along the river. And in 2021, Scenic Hudson purchased 520 acres that borders the city and the town. And this is an abandoned industrial site where Portland cement was produced from 1959 and as recent as 1979. And it was also the site of brickmaking, quarrying, and ice harvesting over the years. And a mile-long portion of the Empire State Trail was constructed by the city of Kingston and runs along the length of the property near the river. This site is owned by the state, but it's managed by Scenic Hudson. And just to note, Scenic Hudson now supports something like 45 parks or something like that on their website, many of which were former industrial sites, which have been restored and open to the public. So there's just a few examples of how we're transforming the river.
That's impressive.
It's really pretty interesting.
It is.
Yeah.
Really
interesting.
Very nice.
Yeah. Thank you.
So that report that Nancy referenced, Between the Railroad and the River, that came out in 1990. And one of the things that led to was the purchase of a lot of the land that has become public access. So that report identified every place where there was a peninsula on the riverside of the railroad tracks, of which there are not many.
Like and, three, right?
Well, no, there were, I think, what did you say, 44?
Well, there were 44 that are identified examples in the report.
And some of them were publicly owned but not developed for access, but most of them were privately owned. And of that number, I think at least two-thirds, maybe even more, have now been brought into public park or recreation usage. And I talked to Steve Rosenberg, who recently retired from Scenic Hudson. He said that when he was at Scenic Hudson, he used that report as his master plan, basically. This is where Scenic Hudson should concentrate its activity. This is where the organization should be buying land. This is where they should be developing parks. So he referenced that report quite a lot, and at DEC we referenced it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so in addition to the development of facilities at these parks, a lot of them were purchased as a result of identifying these peninsulas. So Denning Point, which is now a state park, was one of the properties that was then an industrial site. It was the Nosting Pin Ticket Company that ran it. It had been a previous brickyard. It had a long, long history of human occupation and many different uses for the site. But it was privately owned.
Right, a swimming operation. I mean,
yeah.
You know, there were changing rooms and all that kind of stuff for people to swim there.
I didn't know that.
At Denning Point?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, huh.
So Denning Point was one of the properties, I don't know, 50, 60, 70 acres, something like that, that came into public ownership as a result of the report identifying this as a site that could be developed for public access. You mentioned Kawawisi, unique area.
Mm-hmm.
Started out being informally called Sloop Hill by people. We later found out that Sloop Hill was a different spot in Cornwall, nearby. But that was a property on the riverside of the railroad tracks in New Windsor, on the north side of the Moodna Creek. And that was being proposed for a major residential development.
Yeah.
And it had gotten quite far along in the approval process. But we were able to negotiate with the owner. The housing market was in flux at that time. I think he, in the end, decided it was better to sell the property to the state than to try to develop it. But that property was another major property, at least a mile-long beach on the Hudson, that was acquired as a result of that river and the railroad report.
Critical habitat.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Newton
Hook.
Just to note that the Heritage Task Force...
Yeah.
the Heritage Task Force played a really big role in making that.
Right. The report was organized by the Heritage Task Force for the Hudson River Valley. John Doyle was ahead of it at the time. The Heritage Task Force later merged with the Greenway, and so that work was taken over by the Greenway. But those early days, John Doyle was kind of the spark plug for that report.
And the whole Sloop Hill.
And he was definitely the spark plug for getting that Sloop Hill
right.
property acquired and renamed as Kawawisi and managed by Orange County. Newton Hook. Mm-hmm. Betsy, do you want to say a word about Newton Hook? Well, again, private property that not all of it was owned. You would know more about it than I would, Betsy.
Let me give it a shot.
Yeah.
So I think this is a roughly 72-acre property up in on the just north of Stockport in Stuyvesant, right on the river. Most of the property, all of the property was west of the railroad, and there are two large knolls connected by a level area. And it was slated for development, subdivision into, I think, four, you know, house properties, but it was really, it turned out to be a staggeringly important site from a cultural history standpoint and from a natural history standpoint. So that, again, wasn't an easy one to, you know, there were people wanting to develop it and wanting to buy it, and Scenic Hudson came in and was able to pre-acquire it for DEC. And then flip it to, you know, DEC purchased, covered the purchase price and their invested time. But it's one of those sites that was an industrial site. It had an ice house on it, and it also had, it was sandwiched between a series of brickyards and brickyard ruins. But it also had a really significant role in terms of being in a line, in a signaling line for early people, pre-contact peoples living in the Hudson Valley. And so a lot of archaeological work was done in the course of possibly developing it into a boat launch, and uncovered some really significant things. A lot of several sites, including a place that showed that there had been dwellings. There were post-mold holes there. Mm-hmm. And then from a natural history standpoint, some important and valuable wetlands and shoreline, as well as just important access points for people to come down to the river, people to fish, people to launch car-top boats. So that got developed into a car-top boat launch, and it was incorporated into the Hudson River National Estuary and Research Reserve as the northern mile in a five-mile section of protected areas. And the ice house was, DEC was able to raise funding to stabilize the ice house. Scenic Hudson was supportive of that, and they had acquired the conservation easement to keep this the sort of the largest, most intact example of an old Hudson River ice house. So the ice house footprint is there, and the ice house powerhouse and chimney are relatively stable. So anyway, another great site protected that happened because it was in that report and because people took an interest in it and because people were there to build the coalition for protecting it right at the critical time when it was about to be lost to development. So another win, a big win.
And it turns out the availability of funding is a crucial factor in this. So there was a bond act in 1972, another bond act in 1986, both of which had money for land acquisition.
I worked hard on the 86 one.
Yeah, you might want to say a few words about that.
Oh.
At any rate, it became possible for us to acquire these properties because all of a sudden there was funding available through bond acts that had been passed by voter referendum, the vote of the people of New York approved funding for land acquisition, for clean water projects, clean air projects, and so on. And so as we were identifying these projects, the money was there, and there was a lot of interest in showing rapid progress. You know, if people pass a bond act, people want to see results. And we were there with projects handy. It's like, well, how about this one? How about, and we had willing sellers. So a lot of things converged to make it possible for us to really substantially increase the access. Yeah. And then there were other places like Skodak Island State Park, which was state-owned, but completely undeveloped. And you couldn't get there because of the railroad tracks. It was an at-grade crossing. It was just too dangerous to encourage a lot of people to access that park. So, again, the funding that we had through the estuary program made it possible to build a bridge over the tracks and open up that park, which is vast, you know, really, I can't remember how many acres, but over 100 acres, yeah. I think, maybe considerably more. So do you want to say a word, Kara, about the Bond
about,
Act?
Actually, I think you summarized it nicely. I was thinking about visual access also.
Oh, yeah.
And it wasn't part of the estuary program, but the Hudson River Foundation had the improvement fund.
Mm.
And we were also funding, Fran and I were both on the committee for that distribution of funding. And in addition to access points, an early project was restoration of the four lighthouses in the mid-Hudson that were basically crumbling into the river.
Right.
And we were able to give grants that enabled community groups to take those lighthouses on and restore them. And they're still extremely important visually on the river, and people do have access to them. The Saugerties Lighthouse is a bed and breakfast, and both Esopus and Athens, there are boat trips that go out to those lighthouses. So it's a different kind of access.
Yeah, and the Kingston Lighthouse is publicly
accessible. And the Kingston
Lighthouse
is publicly accessible.
Mm-hmm. Esopus Meadows, when you said Esopus, it was the Esopus
Meadows.
Esopus
Meadows, yeah.
You're talking
and the
about.
Kingston Lighthouse.
And
know,
Hudson,
the,
Athens.
The their solar boat takes people out for tours of the lighthouse, and it's still furnished, and it's, you know, people are astonished by what's there. Yeah.
Another aspect of access that we didn't have as much to do with but was really significant was the passage of the Greenway legislation, which basically they took the legislation that created the New York State Heritage Task Force and changed it up to become the Hudson River Valley Greenway. And as part of that, they created a vision for a Greenway trail on both sides of the Hudson from New York City to the Adirondacks, I think. And so at the time, that seemed like an impossible feat. You know, it would be going through private lands, and there really wasn't that much access to begin with. But over the decades, that really has come to fruition and was eventually embraced as the Empire State Trail by Governor Andrew Cuomo, who took the pieces that had been slowly been assembled over, you know, many decades and found the connecting links and put them all together. So there's now, the trail is not necessarily on the river. In some places it's on the river, in some places it's quite far back. So here in New Paltz, the Empire State Trail goes through New Paltz. Crosses a couple of bridges.
Yeah.
And so the Greenway Trail was another type of access that took a long time to fulfill a vision, but has really come about.
Yeah.
I mean, they're conceptually kind of similar and relate to the importance of connectivity across the landscape for the movement of wildlife and for recreational use. But the Greenway, to my thinking, at least initially, was much more focused on enabling communities to do better planning, and I mean, it eventually got to trails, but there was a lot of attention paid to better planning by the Greenway.
Land use planning.
Land use mm-hmm. planning, right.
Well, the Greenway has two parts.
Yeah.
Right.
It's got the council
And the Conservancy.
And the Conservancy. And mm-hmm. they had different missions. And one was sort of the planning part and one was the trail part.
Yeah.
And they sort of merged together when you have a meeting, but they were two different entities.
Right. And the trail part really emphasized working with local communities that were had their own trail systems. So again, they would give grants to, you know, same similar to what we were doing to local groups if they wanted to propose 1 mile of trail in their community. You know, they could come to the Greenway for a grant and get $5,000, $10,000, right. something like that, and that would be enough to create a length of trail. And gradually, those little pieces started to add up.
Going back to your question about the gunks. What we were doing there, it was a 90,000-acre study area where we were developing an ecological management plan for that intact forest. And one of the things that we realized, and I'm bringing this back to the Greenway in a minute, is that even though a lot of that land was protected, the decisions about land use were being made by 8 different towns that weren't really talking to each other and didn't really realize they had a shared resource to be thinking about. So one of the things that we did do, first of all, we got the different agencies that manage the land on the ridgetop to communicate and plan together. So when you read the master plans today of Minnewaska and Mohonk, which are now the two major landholders, and the Palisades Interstate Park Commission, the principles are all the same. And that was through a collaborative effort along the ridge. And that and then we reached out to the 8 communities, and we had the supervisors meeting on a regular basis, and we were providing those communities with information about what habitat exists in their community that they kind of have responsibility for when they think about land use planning, which relates to the ideas, some of the ideas of the Greenway in terms of land use planning, and then very much to the biodiversity program at the estuary program, which was creating a whole cadre of people, citizens and elected officials, who were better understanding the natural resources of their own community and how it related to the bigger landscape, what the context was, where were the potential connections in the landscape, and what could be done to protect them, from a land-based perspective. Obviously, the river is a really big connector, too.
Yeah.
But so those things do all kind of relate, and they all come from similar principles.
So before we jump into the land use part of things, you know, back to access.
Yeah, I didn't mean to take us away from access.
Yeah, no, it's an important point. I think back to access, one of the things that was happening, I will place it in the 1970s because I remember I wrote a college paper, and I went to college 1970 to 1974. So somewhere in that time frame, I wrote a college paper about rails to trails, which was a new thing that was happening. Railroads were starting to abandon a lot of their rights of way, and there was a lot of consolidation in the railroad industry. And, you know, at the same time, highways were being developed, and, you know, trucking was starting to overtake
shipping
by rail. So there was this whole opportunity to take these abandoned railroad rights of way and turn them into trail systems. And so I think the early impetus for that might have come from the Washington, D.C. area. But soon after, there was an opportunity here in the Hudson Valley. I remember when I was starting my career, I was invited to be on the board of the Wallkill Valley Land Trust, which was created to purchase the rights-of-way for the Wallkill River Railroad and turn it into a rail trail. So that was our first project, and it took a few years to make that happen. But we did make that happen, and roughly the same time, you know, from 1970s to the, say, mid-1980s, even more recently, a lot of those railroad rights of way throughout the Hudson Valley have now been acquired. There's a really big one on the Harlem Valley Railroad and in Eastern Dutchess County, Eastern Columbia County. enormous rail trail over there, and then the walkway over the Hudson was an abandoned railroad right of way.
The Ontario and Western.
Yep.
In Hurley.
The D&H, is it? D&H? O&W?
O&W.
There are a bunch of them.
Yeah. The whole northern part of the Ashokan Reservoir system is now, that was, turned into a rail trail too.
Right.
The whole railroad line.
So
it's amazing how many small railroads there were.
A lot of small railroads.
Private railroads.
Yeah. A lot of them went out of business.
Mm-hmm.
And that left this huge network of relatively flat rail trails now that have been developed for public access, for walking, for bicycle riding, and that again formed much of the framework for the eventual Empire State Trail that's now quite popular.
Yeah.
And that we all use extensively
to get around,
to maintain our health and to get around and have fun.
Yeah.
When I'm on the rail trail, I'm always astonished at the amount of work, of human labor that went into creating those rail beds,
mm-hmm.
because they didn't just exist.
Right. Right. And they're durable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
couldn't afford to build them now.
No. Couldn't afford to acquire them. There's no way you could get the rights across public property and private property to build these interconnected networks.
And you probably couldn't get through Seeker to do all the blasting of all the rock cuts that occurred.
People welcomed having the railroad run by or run across their property that made it seem like there might be some profit in it for them.
Right. Yeah.
The connection to the outside world.
Yeah. So I think the Walkell Valley Railroad... I'm trying to think. I'm pretty sure that would have been around 1990 or so when that abandonment finally came through.
Hmm.
Well, Sarah Johnston remembers it, the train running through New Paltz.
I remember the train running through New Paltz, and they used to deliver lumber to Lefevre's Lumber Yard, which is now housing.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And there was a big debate about which side of the Walkell it should be on.
Really?
The farmers wanted it on the west side, and the commercial operators, the lumber yards and stuff, wanted it on the east side.
Mm.
You saw who won.
Yeah. So a lot of these things take decades for the vision to come to reality. But I think Nancy's point is a really good one, that having that vision allows people to come together and organize around an idea and to present it in a way that people can visualize what it might be like to have this asset. And then the political support, the financial support often comes into play when you have that initial vision that people can get behind.
Well, it's tricky because when you pointed out with the bonds, the money was there and it had to be spent.
Yeah.
And that often happens, and it's a very good thing when there's a vision that spreads the money around with some equity, like a rail trail system.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
So yeah, because multiple communities benefit.
Yeah, and the rail trails go through cities, they go through villages, they go through the countryside.
Right.
So they really do become incredible connectors for people, of all walks of life.